We're now entering the second session for our theme of creative practice. And the next session, we've covered international, we've covered regional, and now we're going to explore Aboriginal creative practice. Our keynote speaker this morning is going to be Rhoda Roberts. And when it was decided earlier this year that the inaugural Arts Date was to be held on Widjibal land in Bunjilung country, who else could we ask to deliver a keynote on Aboriginal creative practice than the amazing Rhoda? That she was not only available but was also willing to direct our magnificent opening last night was a small miracle, as she is in such demand across the country. She's currently head of Indigenous programming at the Sydney Opera House, and only last weekend was there delivering Home Ground and the Associated Dance Rights program to a huge audience that has been growing every year as the premier First Nations event in Sydney. She's festival director of the Boomerang Festival and curator of the second annual Pachumi, a Festival of Light event in Alice Springs, which she's told me this week is that they want her back. I'm not surprised. We'll be here all day if I recite her full CV, but notably, Rhoda was recently awarded an AO for her services to the arts. So please join with me in welcoming Rhoda Roberts.
Hi everyone. Thank you, Elizabeth, so much for this wonderful opportunity to reflect on our First Peoples creative practice. Jingala widawaya jugun widjibal. I'd like to acknowledge our wisdom men and women of the past, our knowledge keepers of today, and our tradition bearers of tomorrow. They are always around us, and I pay my deepest respects to being on country. This week is a very sad time for the Bunjilung Territories. We've lost two of our most senior men. The late Mr. L. Bostock, who was a pioneer across television and film. And the late Mr. S. Belair, who led the struggle in the early 70s, the Aboriginal Medical Service and the Legal Service. I honour their families and I thank them for ensuring that we always have those wisdom men and women. I'd also like to welcome all of you here today, and indeed our international guests. But I want to make one mention of someone very special, a young Sami sister who's travelled all the way across to be with us here. So Caroline Trolvik, welcome to Lismore. Are you here? Great. Our Widjibal oral chronicles of country, clan and custodial responsibility shapes us, it guides us and it encourages us about the knowledge and values that foster a cultural narrative that is all-encompassing. I believe New South Wales is the gateway to Aboriginal Australia. Our spirituality is intimately linked to our country. Last night at the opening gathering that was held at a place that has become fondly known as the Quad. But it's a site that is known by my people as Gurumbal, the Hoop Pine. And last night, through the drenching, cleansing rain, I thought of those hoop pines across our territories. And I knew this is where I come from and this is where I will go back to. Like those nettles that compost under your feet. I'm spiky at times. I've also learnt to be very flexible, compromising. But as an Aboriginal arts worker, can I be moulded to fit the box? That hoop pine, like our goanna, defines me. They are our spiritual totems that have shaped me, shaped our country, and continuously remind us of the obligation and the legacy that we have inherited. It's a rightful inheritance that is sadly not seen as visible as those majestic hoop pine trees that circle our estates. But I'm confident because we are slowly seeing change. As a 3,000th generation Widjibal woman, I'm also defined as the daughter of Frank and Muriel Roberts, as the granddaughter of Frank and Dorothy Roberts Sr., as the cousin of the first Aboriginal Olympian, Frank Francis Roberts, as the twin sister of an unsolved murder victim, Lois Roberts, as the cousin of an unsolved murder victim, Lucy MacDonald, as the great-granddaughter of Lyle and Bella Roberts Sr. Grandfather Lyle was the last man to be fully initiated on our Bundjalung territories. And I think that's incredible when you know that this occurred during the reign of the APA, the Aborigines Protection Act. The songlines of my grandfathers, my uncles and my dad that have been recorded and handed down also define the paths we take, the boundaries I have crossed safely, and the knowledge of the nations and clans that make up the landscape of Australia, this large island. I've learnt the greetings of our neighbours from the east to the west, the north to the south. I have learnt only a very small amount of the ritual. And I will always be known in our communities as a girl, because I have never gone through business. But I continue my life as my children educate me. I will remind them of the relationship to those ancestral creatures that are featured in our age-old stories, the Dirungan, the Nimbinji, the three brothers, the Jura, the tangible and the intangible that circles our worlds. Dreaming is the environment. We live in it and it exists today. It is all around us and reminds us of the yesterdays and the tomorrows. But it's not about time. It's not about the past. Time is a word we need to use and use it loudly. And we need to use that word in the now. It's time we have a vocal right with our inheritance, with a voice that matches and slams into the new technology of the era we're in. We are the scientists of yesterday and the future. We are the environmentalists of a yesterday and a tomorrow. We are the event managers from the ancient rituals to the festivals, the gatherings, the openings, the celebrations, the stories, the music. They all continue the songline. We are and always will be the dancers and the storytellers. So the way I look at it is, our cultural legacy has a valued-based dialogue. It comes with a real national responsibility. So is it an Aboriginal duty for those engaged in the art and cultural sectors? Or is it a concern for all of us, white or black, in the creative industry? The chronicles, the legacy and responsibility of a valued-based dialogue, for me, is a key and very vital ingredient in my everyday work, no matter what I do. But how is it measured? How is it measured in peer assessment for competitive funding rounds? How is it enshrined in a national cultural policy? So I do question the commitment and value relating to the arts and First Nations cultural practices, particularly in the eastern and southern states. For too long and often too frequently, we see Aboriginal profiling in the media. And having travelled the country recently, going to art fairs, festivals and various other events, I'm really saddened when I stand in Darwin and there's a national map of the various art centres across the country. The only dot that's not on that map is New South Wales. And, dare I say it, even some of our own colleagues suggest, well, it's New South Wales, it's not quite authentic, it's not quite relevant. But it is relevant to have cultural programming from the eastern regions. And then every day something great happens. So we are changing. I walk into this building today, Lismore City Hall, a building that sits on the land once known as Duggarimba. It sits on Bounty Street. And there before my eyes, I'm reminded of Bounty. The Bounty that once sat so proud on this land and taught our people from the carved trees, the caves, the chronicles that told of the stories, that told of our religion, that showed us the markings of the Wyabal, the Widjabal, and the other clan groups that make up the Bundjalung homelands. So I just want to thank Digby Moran, my countryman. Incredible art. I hope you've seen to the left of the building the sand sculpture. And I would suggest it is very authentic and it indeed is very relevant. So are we valuing our First Nations artists, performers and companies? And how are we really measuring the cultural value? Is it by listing an arts company's efficiency, their financial box office return, the number of bed nights? Because now we live in a society and in many applications and production areas, we tend to now look at the number of likes on social media for a production. We boast about it. We boast about the number of media clips and mentions in the press. But I think this says more about us as a peoples rather than about culture. I think maybe there's a disconnection between the evaluation requirements and the rhetoric that consistently speaks of treasuring and nurturing art. I believe we should encourage tenacity, allow the practice to germinate with a values-based dialogue that has a long-term narrative, that enables risk-taking and failure as part of that process. What do we actually want to achieve when we look at values and how we measure? Through our KPIs, through our reconciliation action plans, what is the benefits of a First Nations cultural narrative that really takes a generation to gain, understand, and benefit from? But it's a value that enables a constant interconnectivity, and it creates well-being for all Australians. So if this is the case, I really believe we need to take some hard steps and have those very difficult conversations. When I started in the industry some years ago, my dad would say to me, learn the system, because when you learn the system, you can create change for a tomorrow. And I'd hear it from the old people all over the country, learn the system. And then I start to think, what did they really mean? Did they really mean a tomorrow that was of yesterday? If we learn the system, we can bring the yesterday into now. And I think we are starting to arrive at that place. Who are we? Our writers, our directors, our performers, our arts workers. We have this constant conversation. Am I an Aboriginal arts worker or am I an arts worker? And there's conflicting views, and that's fantastic. But no matter how we identify ourselves in the arts and what we want to do with our practice, and it's very varied, I think what we're always trying to do is seeking, challenging, thinking, trying to actually combine that yesterday with today. Because after all, that's what the dreaming is. It's the past, the present, the future. I left Lismore at the age of 18 with this desire to travel the world. I had a bit of a tick box. I had dreams that I would write and direct great Australian plays. So I had to visit the house of a dying John Keats in Rome, because my mother had introduced me to his poetry very early on. She introduced me to all the classics. My father introduced me to the writings of Stokey Carmichael and Ujuru Noonuccal. Back then, I knew her as Nana Walker. She was one of our first published writers, and she wrote a poem for her son, Dennis. And that poem really touched me, and I think it really changed my tiny little worldview. And I'd like to just read that poem, if you'll allow me, because it sits in my heart very deeply. My son, your troubled eyes search mine, puzzled and hurt by colour line, your black skin as soft as velvet shine. What can I tell you, son of mine? I could tell you of heartbreak, hatred blind. I could tell you of crimes that shame mankind, of brutal wrongs and deeds align, of rape and murder, son of mine. But I'll tell you instead of brave and fine, when lives of black and white entwine, and men in brotherhood combine, this would I tell you, son of mine. So those last few words had a huge impact on me. When lives of black and white entwine, and men in brotherhood combine. She talked like my great-grandfather, of the past and the future. There was a way forward. My grandfather, Lyle Sr., set down three principles for his descendants to live by. Number one, retain pride of race and colour. Number two, retain identity and language. And the third point, consider all other people to make the best of life for the future. This three-point plan guides me and reminds me of the importance of why we do what we do, of the interconnectivity we should ensure. The arts is about enabling the classics to be retained, to witness the dance, to enable the music to be heard, the books to be printed, the plays to be produced, and plays and writings and films that reflect our society. So every time I approach a creative work, I consider those principles as part of my creative process. I also consider the four directions that influence that process. They are important to Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islanders across this country, and indeed I'm sure they're just as important to many First Nations around the world. The four directions reflect the Father Sky people, our spirituality, the importance of the Southern Cross. It's represented in our markings. It determines the law, the ceremony, the kinship structures or our moieties and our languages. It was a four-direction approach that we used as an arc during the 1980s at the Aboriginal National Theatre Trust, proudly known as ANT. It was the third national theatre company to be developed. And every play we produced, devised or wrote had an outcome. In the 1980s, we held the first National Black Playwrights Conference. It was when the theatre mantle was handed to the next generation, the continuing of the intergenerational exchange. At that conference, I'll name some of the playwrights: Bob Mazza, Justine Saunders, Ujuru Noonuccal, Hillis Maris, Jack Davis, Kevin Gilbert, Eva Johnson, Bobby Merritt, Brian Siren, Athol Compton, Vivian Walker, Bobby McLeod. Some of these names you might not even have heard of, but they were our pioneers, our innovative directors, groundbreaking writers, and our extraordinary theatre makers. We were young, and amongst us actors to do the readings for their theatre making was Ernie Dingo, Lillian Crombie, Brenda Croft, Lydia Miller, Richard Wally, Michael Johnson and myself, and many more. At the last panel of the conference, that was determined to have some future outcomes. The elders approached us and suggested that we should be setting up the next Aboriginal National Theatre. They gave a 3-year mandate that each year a new work would be produced, that we had to develop the second National Black Playwrights Conference, and we had to incorporate the Aboriginal National Theatre as a trust. So Vivian Walker, Michael Johnson, Lydia Miller and myself were selected. They either thought we were really stupid because we didn't know what we were going to do, or they really did think that we could work. But you see, they knew our families. They knew who we were and where we were from. They know that we had been moulded by our communities and our families, and they knew that we understood or had an awareness but had a long way to learn about our kinship system. And it was bloody hard work. We didn't have any money at first, but Lydia and I, both registered nurses, did night duty so we could run the office through the day. We learned how to fill out grants, get fundraising. We looked at marketing and communications, and we looked at everything it took to produce works. We learnt fast, but the most extraordinary thing, when black and white entwine, so many came forward with their knowledge and their skills from the mainstream theatre industry, and they offered their help. So we learnt fast, and those collaborators gave us great advice. By the year 3, we held the second National Aboriginal Conference, and it was a huge success. There were 6 plays that were produced, ended up touring the world. We had to contact writers, musicians, poets, art curators, various people around the country. And we said we didn't care how it came, what form it came in, we just like to get some writings. Now, you've got to remember, this was the days of fax machines and electric typewriters. We got an electric typewriter. That was so exciting. And the post would arrive daily, and we carry up these parcels that were loaded with envelopes, with structures of poems and songs and letters. And one day, we received a big yellow envelope. I opened it up and 52 pieces of paper fell out. Some were little, some were A4s, there was blotting paper, there was even a serviette, I think. And we picked it up and started reading these various papers. And I recognised lyrics of a song in one of the, you know, it's actually written on an envelope. And it was by a band that I used to play on my show on Radio Redfern. The band was called Cuckles from Broome. Now, I can't sing, but as I hummed those lyrics, we actually looked around the office and we knew we had something great. We had a new genre that we hadn't gone into, a musical. So when the Playwrights Conference opened, a playwright from WA by the name of Jimmy Chai arrived. He just had songs. So the actors, Kylie Belling, Lydia and myself, along with Lawrence Clifford, Ernie Dingo and Francis Little, sat in a workshop with Ujuru Nunukul, Bob Mazza, Brian Siren, and we structured the dialogue between the songs. On the last day of the conference, we had developed 2 scenes and a reading, and the audience roared, "There's nothing I would rather be than to be an Aborigine and watch you take my precious land away." We knew we had a hit. Jimmy Chai stood in the middle of that theatre and held that script, that group devised script, high up in the air. And he said, "It's now been written, and the Aboriginal National Theatre Trust will produce this, and we will tour it around the world." My dreams and hopes of leaving Lismore at the age of 18 were coming to fruition. But of course, the next day, the scepticism began. How could young black Aboriginal people from the east coast of New South Wales even develop a work of this structure? There was seriously no faith or commitment in the work we had been doing. For 3 years, we'd had a hit every season. Thanks to Sue Natras, who offered a venue in Victoria at the Arts Centre. You see, when we were running the Aboriginal National Theatre Trust and producing plays, we couldn't get a venue in Sydney because they weren't quite sure how an all-Aboriginal produced production could work. But Sue Natras had seen our work and she had faith and belief. And so she gave us a venue in Victoria. And most of the plays had to extend 2 weeks, and we made a killing at the box office. It was absolutely fantastic. And then again, change occurred. A young woman by the name of Chris Westwood joined Belvoir Street Theatre, and she decided that an all-Aboriginal produced production could be effective in Sydney. And so we started to do our work at Belvoir Street. But when she left, a new artistic director arrived on the scene, and he felt that while the writing was good, there's no way an Aboriginal could direct a play. He had absolutely no faith in our ability. You see, I think he'd been affected by the Aboriginal profiling in the media. So we thought, what the hell? It is what it is. And we moved into television and filmmaking, documentary making. We began to write and direct our own work independently. There was one period of time where we were getting a lot of work as actors. All we wanted to do, though, was direct. And we probably gave those poor directors who were directing us in those shows an awful time because we were young and knew it all. So we pooled our money. And we decided, why don't we get someone and commission them to write what we want to do? Because we would go onto a set or a theatre show and we'd have to put on the gammon blackfella voice, be the prostitute, the drunk, and there was no way we were able to show the depth of what we thought was extraordinary as actors. And so we decided we'd do it ourselves. And then we looked for a writer. And we thought, we'll get the flavour of the month so we get the attention. We're a bit mercenary about it. So I was looking at David Williamson's plays and I'm going, okay. Yeah, everyone goes to his plays. But at the time, Louis Naura was doing an awful lot of work. So we pooled our money and we went and saw Louis Naura and we gave him a brief. This is all we have, but we want to commission you to write this play. And in fact, when I look at what we pay playwrights now, when we commission them, Louis did very well. So we said to him, we want you to write a play about three sisters. We do not want the word Aboriginal mentioned once. And we want the three sisters to return to their homelands after 10 years for their mother's funeral. And we want every emotion under the sun so we can show how fabulous we are. And so every Friday night, for a period of about 8 months, we did every restaurant on Glee Point Road. It was absolutely fantastic, actually. And Louis had a little dictaphone. So we go off to dinner, and sometimes Lydia would cook the dinner. And throughout the dinner, we would talk about these characters and become those characters. At the end of that 8 months, we had a script and we called it Radiance. And we were able to put it on at Belvoir Street Theatre. But under the reign of that AD, unfortunately, we were not allowed to have an Aboriginal director. So that poor director with Lydia and Rachel Mazza and me, my goodness. Anyway, it was a great success, and of course it's gone on to see many companies now produce it. It's on the school curriculum, and it changes people's thought process of the diversity of who we are as peoples. We have varying opinions, and we actually fight amongst ourselves, and that's okay. I don't think when we were commissioning Louis that we'd actually thought of that long-term future for that production, but I'm so thrilled we did it. But we had to do it. We just had to make that change ourselves. And now we're seeing across the country many of you looking at extending friendships with your local regions, your communities in that region, making sure that our venues are accessible to Aboriginal people. Now, this is where I get a bit cranky, because I think that's brilliant. Of course you need to speak to your elders in your community, the custodians of those lands. And often we'll see productions get up. And I come from training under Brian Siren and all those writers I mentioned. And their big thing and task in life was to tell us our culture was of excellence and sophistication. It was not mediocre or tokenistic. And yet, when I go and see some great community project, I'm delighted because our people have access to culture. Because you've got to remember, in New South Wales, for a very, very long time, there was no voice. It was the era of silences. We weren't allowed to speak our language, sing our songs, or do our dances. But hell, we kept those languages alive. But in our communities, there are many, many who have gone off to train in big cities, be it at NASDA or at acting school or drama or producing or filmmaking. And yet when we come back to a small region where the greatest stories are, not one of them are involved in those projects. And it's really unfair because they have the craft, they have the training. They are learning the knowledge from those elders and custodians, but they're almost invisible. And then we see a production that is mediocre. And it just infuriates me. So please, if you're working with community, think about the expertise. The other thing that gets on my goat, I'll just get this out and then we'll get back to some nice things. The other thing that gets on my goat is... Oh, how do I put this nicely?
Don't worry.
Oh, you're arts people. I can even say fuck, can't I? Okay. I rang before I was doing this keynote because I was so incredibly nervous because you are my peers and my colleagues. And I was thinking, what the hell can I say? Because sometimes it can be so exciting and wonderful when you work with a great team, and other times it can just be like you just want to give up. Because you'll go onto a set or you'll be in a production workshop or something. And if I was doing the Irish play or the play that shouldn't be mentioned, the first thing I would do as a director or an actor would learn the nuances of that character, would go to the expertise about how I would lilt my T's for an Irish accent. So I'd bring in a language expert from Ireland, or, you know, an Irish speaker. But our actors, our writers, our directors, no matter where they work in the creative industries, they come with all this to carry the load of the chronicles and the responsibility. That's before they even get in the door to actually do the job they're employed to do. And then, of course, they're Aboriginal. Oh, my God, an Aborigine in the arts. Could you please tell me, what's the Aboriginal word for water? Oh, look, we've got this in the script. It doesn't sound right. Can you tell us how an Aborigine would say that? And so the writer, the director, whoever they are rewriting that script. are giving the knowledge or advice of the local community, which they may not even come from. Oh, who do we contact here? Can you tell me? Oh, look, I'm looking for an Aboriginal dance group. Could you tell me? Oh, great. Well, where would you like the dance group? Where are you doing the event? Perhaps you need to go to that community. Oh, great. And what's your budget? Budget? No, they'd be really pleased to be promoted and that we're having them at the event. Actually, no, it's their business. This is what we do for a living. You wouldn't expect the plumber to come to your house and know about how to fix the computer. It's the same thing. And it's not only for our artists, but it's also for our community to understand. We're trained. This is our business. This is our livelihood. And we need the respect because the expertise is across this community, and yet they sit there silent and invisible because they're not approached. So that's my other little beef. Was that all right? Because I'm a little over the Ooga Booga stuff, you know? So we're often there as the consultant as well. And, you know, we know everything. Oh, my God, we know this much. And Aboriginal culture is not a homogenous society. And back in the 80s, when we were getting all ready to be in this industry and just loving it, and I still love it, I love every day and I love everyone I work with, because every single person, no matter who they are, teaches me something. And I have to remind myself to be open to that. But back in the 80s, we started looking at how we would sell the work. What was the imagery we were using? What were the titles of work? And I went into this big thing of going, oh, no, don't do a language word, because then they'll know it's black and they won't come. So we learned a lot about what would be the image for the poster, how would we sell it, and that if we involve cultural art, it almost seemed like a deterrent. But then we moved into the 90s and everyone started talking about branding, and we started to look that we could, it had changed. In fact, we could use the language. We could put imagery of our art and people would get excited. And perhaps we were preaching to the converted, but again, change is slow to come, but we are making change. The branding and logo of the new Yirrumboy Festival in Melbourne this year captured the essence of who we are and how we snugly fit with the way we have always been. And I don't know if you remember it, but they had Yirrumboy, and then underneath, in reverse, they had tomorrow, because Yirrumboy is tomorrow. And I thought that was the perfect, it was a great logo. And then I looked at what Victoria was doing in their arts. And they are ensuring they support an industry-based festival that showcases the business of our culture and allows the voice of our theatre makers and artists. The Northern Territory, where I've done a lot of work, is certainly committed. I've had the opportunity of working on a number of festivals, such as the Garama Festival and now Parchima Festival. And I have to say, oh boy, go to the Territory. Raising funds, oh my gosh, just comes out of the woodwork. It seems so easily. And easy when you think recently they announced $17 million to the arts and creative industry, and that is just for Aboriginal works. I'm about to enter my second year with Parchima, and this is a festival that focuses on installations and a light-up festival. It showcases the visual arts of the Western and Central Desert regions, and it shows that art and culture can bring big bucks. It's an economy that can create independence, has an impact across the local market, and can tackle those very pesky issues of health, housing, and education. But this is where I approve of Aboriginal profiling, because the media has sure helped to ensure that the real culture is in the Northern Territory. I mean, I'm sure you've all seen the Garama material that appears on our screens mid-year, and you count how many politicians have flocked to Garama to have their Aboriginal experience. It's a time for them to put agendas and policy into place. And that's great. I wish they'd come to ours as well. Although, I have to say, we had all those ministers last night, and our Minister for Arts is going to be with us over this weekend. So that's incredibly exciting. Because unlike any of those other states and territories, I am so proud of New South Wales. I'm really proud of the way Create New South Wales is working and the fact that they have incredible expertise with their Aboriginal staff there. But I'm also proud that New South Wales has become the first state in the country to introduce legislation to Parliament to acknowledge the unique value and importance of language to our First Peoples and to the state. Yee-haw! And you know, that makes me proud because we have never lost our language here. The only time we've lost language is when someone's passed on. But there's always the exchange, and our language is as vital as it was back in my grandfather's day. The South Australian government did a deal this year for $17.54 million from BHP to support what they've termed the largest Aboriginal festival, Tanandi. In the Pitjantjatjara language, there's an expression called Narpachi Narpachi that means I give you something, you give me something. This is the spirit of equal exchange, mutual responsibility, and it underpins all good relationships. Tanandi, the word from the traditional owners of the Adelaide Plains, it means to come forth or appear, like the sun and the first emergence of light. And for many cultures, first light signifies new beginnings. And I think we are on a new beginning. But then I look at the team at BHP, and of course it was sponsored by BHP Olympic Dam, and they do see Tanandi as a new beginning, and they were praised by the media for their support. Let me just remind you of the Olympic Dam. It's on Cockathaw lands, and the mine uses the water required for its processing from the Great Artesian Basin. This is water for our future that has been in safekeeping under the ground. And over the years, we've seen so much environmental degradation around that land. But when they opened that festival, there was not one word said of how tarnished Olympic Mine, Olympic Dam, background was. Journalists praised them. They were a contribution to the heartland of Australia's First Peoples. I just need to remind those journalists, God help them, what are they teaching these days in communications? Australia is a First Nations country and all land is Aboriginal. How often do we hear someone saying, I'm going bush to get back on country? You're standing on country everywhere in Australia. You're standing on occupied lands no matter where you are. Midnight Oil have been doing their tour recently. Very interesting. Has anyone been to see it? Yeah, I saw it in Alice Springs. Oh my God, truly, they start the beginning of the night with all this energy and it just keeps going. It's quite phenomenal. And of course, they sang a favourite of mine just after Tanandi's $1 million was announced, Blue Sky Mine. And the company takes what the company wants, and there's nothing as precious as a hole in the ground. So in New South Wales, could we accept this type of partnership? Could we take mining money? Would mining money change our gaze, create a new lens? And when it's applied and done well, it opens up dialogues and deepens our discussions. And do those artists at Tanandi feel treasured, recognised and listened to? It's a very different culture on the East Coast. We're very much about our ethics. And I know this because I've learnt your language, I've learnt your religion, your work ethic, your creative practices, the way we define the arts versus culture, the way that money is nurtured, the way that the country has been developed. And I do remember when ignorance was considered bliss. I know all this, as all of you do as well. But we do need to be reminded to listen and be open. And we do need to be reminded that we have to re-educate all the time. You know, recently I asked about that mining money, and I think of Woodford when they took that Santos money. And they were vilified. They lost a lot of loyal audience. And it was for, I think, you know, 100 grand or something. And sure, I wouldn't have taken the Santos money either because of the situation we faced on the Northern Rivers with, you know, coal seam. But then I looked and saw the Santos Adelaide Festival, the Santos Brisbane Festival. But nobody complained there. But in the regions, they attacked Woodford. And it made me think about how we now have to be very creative to get monies to make sure that we do have that long-term narrative. We've seen the culling. We've seen the silences in the last year of the small to medium sector. We've witnessed direct impact of these federal funding cuts. How do we clean up that? How to ensure our creative minds are nurtured. At the Sydney Opera House, we developed through our First Nations programming budgets that would be given to some of those affected. They were destroying our structures and our practice. They were questioning the wealth of our creative minds that write about the status quo, that changed the thinking in this country. That national arts policy, damaging well-being and creating unemployment. That's not a national arts policy I want to work under. I witnessed more and more of my colleagues, black and white, opting out of the sector. They wanted security. They needed a guarantee that their creative minds would be cherished. So what do we do? You know, I think back to the Biennale in Sydney when it announced it would sever its ties with the founding partner, Transfeld. They caved into pressure from artists, the artists who were angered by the ethics of a company that was linked to offshore detention centres. And the Biennale staff were verbally abused with the taunts, "You've got blood on your hands." And those artists that were in that Biennale were torn. They were torn between the loyalty of an event they loved, but they also wanted to make a stand against a horrible government policy. But it did break the creative spirit, and so many turned on the event like they did with Woodford. So why not the same vigilance to other states and events that take unethical money? Just a question. I think we're great in New South Wales because we really consider our work and how we're going to pay for it. We have destinations in New South Wales. Have you seen the recent release of their little ads selling New South Wales to the world? Oh, they go everywhere and they sell all our wonderful destinations. But there is not one Aboriginal in any of these ads. So on that note, I think I'm about time. I just want to end with Uncle Bruce Pascoe. Have you heard of him? So Uncle Bruce wrote a book called Dark Emu. He's just about to release a new book, and this is just some of his writings. And I just think it sums up the way that I've been thinking about the way of creative process. Aboriginal culture, he writes, cannot be summed up in story or myth, because the English translation always reduces it to a diminutive and describes it that way as an Aboriginal story, a myth and legends, when in fact the story is an explanation of the universe. I could explain that by talking about the law in New South Wales and Victoria, he writes, that it's all-encompassing philosophy. But some elements are too close to my artery, and most I don't know sufficiently to give a fully coherent explanation. The best I can do is to talk about a massive plate of rock art near Mount Borrowdale in the Northern Territory, which was shown to me by a mate. To see it properly, you have to lie on your back and see it as the artist. The philosopher saw it. I cannot explain it. It would be indecent of me to try. But it's in the shape of a giant egg. It's a massive thing and it has a border around the egg like the edge of the universe. Inside the egg, everything is everything. The whole of human experience. I had water spilling over my face when I realised what I was looking at, and I felt shame for being a tourist. Was I supposed to be looking at this statement without undertaking the grueling journey towards its unveiling? I won't go back, even though I often dream of the universal egg, and I suppose the dreaming means I don't need to go back. There are some protocols in existence for the handling of Aboriginal art and Aboriginal story, but they will always be inadequate until Australia accepts that our people were the first people and had a philosophy, a spirituality of such enormous power and subtlety that it was adopted year after year after year after year by each new generation for hundreds of thousands of years. Not without changes in style and texture and detail, but just adopted for its profound integrity. And there may be signs that Australia can begin to embrace the Aboriginal story. Redfern Now, The Gods of Wheat Street could not have appeared on Australian television 10 years ago, but perhaps there is an audience now, a willingness to explore beyond the white soap. But art always marches in front of politics and the economy. Flicking onto a few shows or downloading the odd black movie is not the same as adopting those stories as your own history. Australia's readiness to understand the cultural protocols can be evident in our future. So thank you all so much for allowing me this time. And thank you, Uncle Bruce.
Thank you so much, Rhoda. We did allow that to go a little bit over time, but I think Rhoda's message was extremely important. So.